Thank you very much for coming. Sorry we started a little bit late. My name is Sarus Faravar. I am the author of this new book, The Internet of Elsewhere. It's a book about the history and effects of the internet in four different countries around the world, Senegal, South Korea, Iran, and Estonia. I wrote it over the course of the last four and a bit years. I started when I was a journalism student at Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. I graduated in 2005. These days I live and work in Germany as a journalist. I work for Deutsche Welle English, and I also freelance for NPR and PRI's The World and CBC in Canada, and I've written for The Economist and Slate and lots of other places. Anyway, so I thought tonight that I would read a few passages from the book, talk about kind of how they came to be, and then answer any questions that people might have a little discussion, and then I have some books for sale if hopefully you're interested enough to maybe pick one up. So yeah, that's pretty much it. First of all, I'd like to thank Jolie and the Internet Society here in New York, and also Evan Korth from NYU for providing us with this space. And I wanted to start off by a question I get asked a lot. Usually the first question when I tell people about this book is, you know, well, why these four countries? And maybe that's a question that some of you have. And it really started for me as looking at kind of internet penetration and how it exists in various parts of the world. I'm from California. And a lot of, you know, tech companies that we all know and love, you know, Apple, Google, Facebook, Twitter, right? Many of them come from California. And as somebody who is kind of interested in what's happening in other parts of the world, I was intrigued to find out kind of how the internet is being used in various other parts of the world as well. I read at some point that South Korea has the world's most wired country and has the world's kind of cheapest and fastest and most widespread internet access. And so, South Korea was kind of an obvious choice. It's, you know, kind of on one end of the spectrum. Then I would say, you know, if you go to the least connected country, I don't know exactly what the least connected country is, but it's certainly somewhere in sub-Saharan Africa. It might be the Democratic Republic of Congo. It might be Somalia. It might be Zimbabwe. I'm not sure exactly where it is. But the reason why I picked Senegal was not to anchor the other side, but to put Senegal as kind of the best least connected country. Senegal is a country in the western coast of Africa. It has a lot of good things going for it. It is politically stable. It's economically stable. It has had all kinds of government projects, both from the U.S. and from within Senegal, to promote internet access. And yet, internet penetration, that is to say, the number of people on the internet divided by the population, is roughly 10-12%, which is relatively low given all of the kind of attention and things that it has going for it. And then in the middle, I would put Iran and Estonia, Estonia being, again, more toward the Korea side, and Iran being more toward in the middle. Iran's internet penetration rate is about 35%. And what I wanted to show in this book was to kind of talk about how when the internet arrives in a particular place at a particular time, that it kind of collides with what's happening there. Like, we hear a lot about how the internet is an actor on countries. I'm sure many of you have heard this phrase, the Twitter revolution, applied to most recently to countries like Tunisia and Egypt, and previously to Iran, and a little bit to Moldova before that. But there's also this idea of how the internet can change, you know, countries. China, you know, if only the Great Firewall of China were to be torn down, then China would suddenly become democratic. We hear the same thing in Cuba. We hear the same thing with respect to economic development in various parts of sub-Saharan Africa and the developing world as well. And what I'm trying to show is how I think that, and this is why it's called the kind of emergent effects of a wired world, is to show kind of how the internet kind of collides with what's happening in these places at these times and creates kind of new and interesting things, like Skype in Estonia, for example. I guess probably the first thing that I wanted to read was a little bit about, this is from the introduction of the book, which you can read for free on my website if you want, but I'll just take it from here. And this is, again, just kind of introducing this kind of idea. And this is coming off of a part where I'm talking about how things, you know, things that were happening in Iran in recent years about democratization and so forth. What has been happening in Iran during during the 2 decades since the internet first arrived is far more interesting than the simple narrative of a young wired generation throwing off the yoke of an oppressive regime. Iran is a key example of a more complicated and protracted struggle between a government and its people online, a constant seesaw situation in which each side can have the upper hand, depending on the week or sometimes even the day. It's more than just a tale of societal progress and democratization as brought about by the internet. It's deceptively simple to proclaim that Iran's online voices are, quote, nothing short of a revolution within the Islamic revolution, as the Iranian-British author Nasreen Alavi wrote in her 2005 book, We Are Iran. Indeed, for every voice yearning for freedom and reformist politics, there are other voices that simply choose not to engage, voices that are silenced by intimidation and threats, and still other voices that are made more cautious by government agents infiltrating or spreading disinformation on social networks. It is important to recognize the political, economic, and social context in which Iran's unique turmoil online has happened. Iranian politicians did not use Twitter and Facebook by accident. Iconic videos of protesters and sometimes their tragic deaths were not disseminated on YouTube randomly. Iran has a unique political situation as an Islamic republic that attempts to be semi-democratic within the confines of an authoritarian Islamic regime. In Iran's previous elections, subsequent to the establishment of the republic in 1980, there were disagreements and even protests. Many younger citizens were frustrated that President Mohammad Khatami's social reforms of the early 2000s did not go far enough to allow for more newspapers and other forms of political freedom. These reformists were not calling for an out-and-out overthrow of the Islamic Republic, merely substantial reforms within the larger structure. However, in 2009, large numbers of men, women, and children gathered together in the streets of Iran's biggest cities to fiercely oppose what they believed to be outright fraud in an election that the government proclaimed to be authentically democratic. In other words, the government couldn't even win an election that was rigged to begin with. After all, it had disqualified many candidates who did not meet the adequate religious qualifications. The economic troubles are hitting Iran's youth especially hard. This is, after all, a country where half of the population is under 25 years old. These children of the revolution were born after 1979, during a time when Ayatollah Khomeini encouraged Iranian women to have more children while many men were being killed during the 1980-1988 Iran-Iraq War. But now these children are growing up in a country that can educate them. It was more than 10 years ago that women began to outnumber men in Iranian universities. And they're finding that their country cannot adequately provide work and social services for them. So whether the Islamic Republic likes it or not, an entirely new, educated, and wired generation has grown up in Iran with the internet, bootleg satellite television, and mobile phones. However, in a country that cannot create enough jobs for them, in a country that restricts sports, music, and other social freedoms, particularly between the sexes, it's no wonder that so many go online as a form of cheap entertainment. It is this environment of international and domestic political turmoil, economic difficulties, and social restrictions that drives overly educated and understimulated Iranians to the internet. This confluence of events has created a completely unique online outcome that's far more interesting and unpredictable than the Nicholas Negroponte-style techno-determinism. It's no wonder that Iran was the first country to arrest a blogger in 2003, and sadly, the first country to have a blogger die while in prison, 2009. It's no wonder that Iran has been active in trying to influence domestic online activity for over a decade, and has engaged in one of the world's most complicated and devious internet filtration systems, second only to China. It's no wonder that in the aftermath of the June 2009 election, the internet became a key tool in getting information in and out of Iran, as foreign media were barred from the country and the country's own media remained highly restricted. In other words, as the internet has collided with Iran's political, economic, and social realities, it has created a conflict far more complicated than anyone could have imagined. Just like in Iran, when the internet arrives in any country, it bumps up against various pre-existing political, economic, social, and cultural histories and contexts. And often what comes out are rather surprising results. The most fascinating examples of internet-related changes are not happening in Silicon Valley, but rather in far-off, forgotten, or overlooked corners of the globe. Most Americans are generally familiar with the rapid rise in internet technology in the 1990s as more and more people became connected with faster and faster connections. Many of us remember the go-go 1990s when many companies raised unimaginable sums of venture capital on the thinnest of business plans, only to come crashing down in the early 2000s. We've become accustomed to hearing about California companies like Google, Apple, Facebook, Twitter, and many others that purport to revolutionize the way we gather, store, and share information. However, in the United States, we often forget about the Minitel, first released in 1982, which was France's predecessor to the internet, and allowed users to check sports scores and buy train tickets through computer terminals in nearly every home. We're largely unaware of the fact that across the European Union today, most banks can easily accept online electronic bank transfers for free, while most Americans still pay with paper checks, a technology that has not changed substantially since the early 20th century. Looking at Asia, we often don't know about how China, in many ways, could represent the future of the internet, in that it has the largest single user group from one country, and yet it has the most sophisticated filtration system and censorship system in the world. In South Asia, we celebrate the rapid rise of India and its middle-class staffed call centers as the center of Thomas Friedman's flat world, without understanding how or why this nation used its education system and English language ability to leap forward as a result of its rich modern history. Turning to Latin America, few Americans know the story of how in 1996, Brazil became the first country in the world to introduce electronic voting, more than 4 years before the Help America Vote Act that emerged in the aftermath of the November 2000 American election debacle. Many of us also forget about the meteoric rise of Star Media, a Spanish and Portuguese language web portal founded by a 30-year-old Uruguayan who grew up in Connecticut. When Star Media went public in 1999, the first Latin American internet company to do so, it hit a market capitalization of over $1 billion, later reaching $3.8 billion. Africa, of course, is still stereotyped as the dark continent even well into the 21st century, as it lags behind in electricity production and internet connectivity. However, South Africa is regarded as a contemporary beacon of economic growth and hope for the entire continent, especially having hosted the World Cup international soccer tournament this past year. After all, it has the highest gross domestic product in all of Africa, and it has the highest rate of internet connectivity, with approximately 11% of its population online. Furthermore, the African National Congress was one of the earliest African political parties to maintain a web presence. However, while much of Africa is underconnected to the internet, and areas of East Asia and Northern Europe have the highest rates of internet penetration, we must ask ourselves how exactly this online landscape has come about and why certain applications, ranging from Kenya's M-Pesa mobile phone and online payment system to Canada's ubiquitous email device, the BlackBerry, have emerged from their respective countries. We are aware of how the internet is fundamentally a means to transmit individual, discrete ideas from one place to another, but we are often not fully cognizant of how the internet can transmit the collective spirit of a nation as well. When the internet arrives in all countries, it does so at a particular moment in history and evolves in a way that is irrevocably stamped with those countries' modern histories and economic environments. The net result is that all countries' online applications and cultures are inevitably distinct, with differences derived from very local characteristics, such as the quality of middle-class education or the culture's particular stripe of national drive. So that kind of lays out kind of where I'm going with this. The first, you know, to do this book, I traveled to all of these countries. And for those of you who know your internet history, you probably know that the founder who actually I had write the foreword to this book, one of the considered, I guess, the godfathers of the internet, the inventor of TCP/IP, I'm sure you all know the name Vint Cerf, who helped to work on the ARPANET back in UCLA in the late 1960s. What I found out, though, while I was trying to figure out how Korea came to develop the internet and why Korea became this kind of crazy wired nation, was that there was this Korean guy. He was actually born and raised in Japan. His name is Chun Kil Nam, and he's widely considered to be the father of the Korean internet. And it just so happens that he was a graduate student at UCLA with Vint Cerf at the time of the creation of the ARPANET. And while Chun Kil Nam didn't actually work on the creation of the ARPANET, it led quite directly to his going back, having been a doctoral student at UCLA in computer science at that time. And during the 1980s, he went back to Korea. I say back to Korea because actually he was born and raised in Japan, although he's ethnically Korean. He went to Korea, lived there for the first time, and learned Korean as an adult, and became a professor at what some people call, you know, Korea's like MIT or Stanford or something. This is a university in Korea called the Korean Advanced Institute of Science and Technology. And this was a government research center that, you know, was working on computer science projects and lots of other things. And anyway, so Chun Kil-nam was put in charge of building the Korean internet in the 1980s. And that's kind of what he did. And he had this sort of environment where he had the best and the brightest of Korean computer science students, and many of them went on to start some of the early Korean broadband companies. There's a famous Korean computer game that predated World of Warcraft that you may have heard of called Lineage that was made by one of his students. There were lots of people that kind of came out of this environment, and I like to think of it kind of as the, again, for those of you who know your Silicon Valley history, you may remember the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, from which many important technologies that we all know and love, like Ethernet and Windows and various other things, came from. So this kind of lab that he had was sort of like that, in the sense that there were lots of Korean things that kind of emerged from there. And I just wanted to read a little section from that to kind of give you a flavor of what that was like, based on, you know, some interviews that I did with him and his former students. This is under the heading Assembling the Team, Chun's First Generation of Graduate Students, 1983 to 1990. Park Hyun-jae remembers most of his graduate school interviews with KAIST professors as being quite easy. But Chun Kil-nam was different. Park had aced the entrance exam for the computer science department, but still had to go through formal interviews with members of the faculty. Professor after professor gave him softball questions, asking him only to present his academic and professional credentials. With such a high score, Park guessed that he could have said nothing of substance and still would have been selected. He had a stellar background and had just finished his studies at Seoul National University, one of Korea's top schools, with a bachelor's degree in sociology. Park wanted to further study human communication, and with computers being increasingly used as a way to correspond, it seemed obvious that computer science and computer-based communication offered the best way to merge these interests. Unlike the other professors, Chun took the interview seriously, albeit casually, and asked him different questions on a single theme, how to get better students at KAIST. He wanted to know how to get KAIST to the level of institutions like the University of California, Berkeley, or the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. In other words, how to raise the level of thinking, scholarship, and research to world-class caliber. Park didn't have much of an answer, but he said that KAIST needed to work as hard as it could to be the best university possible. In the weeks that followed, Park went from lab to lab, spending 7 days among each group of graduate students and their professor. The groups were friendly and welcoming, and each invited him out for a round of drinks at the end of the week, with the exception of Chun's group. Park saw that they were a much more serious bunch and focused their efforts on working and not socializing. This group was tight-knit because of the long hours that they put together in the lab, not because they had spent many nights downing rounds of soju. He knew then that Chun's lab, also the only one with its own computer, was where he belonged. That fall, Park joined Chun's 10 other graduate students, the largest such group in the entire computer science department. Partly because Chun was a new faculty member, and partly because he was highly respected, there was no cap on the number of students that he could oversee. Chun didn't coddle his students. He gave them directions, and if they dropped out, so be it. He didn't really care how many of his students completed their doctoral degrees. The mission was nothing more and nothing less than to get the network, the Korean System Developmental Network, fully operational, to understand its quirks and characteristics, and eventually to figure out how to get it connected to other nation computer networks outside of Korea. The ultimate goal was to build a national computer network along the lines of what the ARPANET had done decades earlier. Chun students were the best of the best computer science graduate students in the country. The government, via the school, had awarded all of them full scholarships, free on-campus room and board, a small stipend, and the highly coveted exemption from military service. Chun would remind them nearly every day that they were the most privileged group in the entire country, and in exchange for that generous opportunity, they should work appropriately hard. Think and act like a professional, he told them on an almost daily basis. On a practical level, Chun changed some of the everyday organizational skills of his students. He insisted that his students keep a written record of everything that they did, and, quote, he always emphasized that verbal communication is just passing things by, recalls Yi Dongman, Chun's first graduate student to complete his doctorate. Quote, if you want to convince people, you have to write. Unlike every other professor in KAIST's computer science department, and likely in the entire country, Chun made his students write a properly formatted one-page progress report on their research each week. These memos, submitted alongside a verbal presentation, were collected at the department's meetings. If even a single page was not properly formatted, Chun would immediately throw it away. Kim Yoon, who managed the lab during the 1984-85 academic year, compared Chun to a drill sergeant, noting that it was in these meetings that Chun pushed his students to improve their English and to study and attend conferences overseas. Yi also recalled that while Chun was tough and demanding, he was also very personable. Quote, he treated his students not as a normal hierarchy, but as peers, he says. The fact that he treated us as colleagues, that was a big difference. We could just sit down together and spend many hours, and he gave us coffee in his office. That was very different from the Korean standard. The work schedule was similar to that of a late 90s Silicon Valley startup. Wake at 9 or 10 a.m., stumble down to the lab from the dorms, work all day, take a quick dinner break, work until midnight or later, lather, rinse, repeat. Chun's students didn't have weekends free either. On Saturday mornings, he would organize hiking, trail running, rock climbing, and skiing trips to the mountains around Seoul. And while he never explicitly told his students that they were required to go, cultural tradition demanded that when a professor invites you to do something, you had to go, whether you wanted to or not. Quote, at that time, that particular time, basically we were looking for something, which is impossible in Korea, or nearly impossible, Chun recalled. Doing the internet back in the 1980s was just about impossible in Korea, so if I had to make it possible, I had to do something very special. I had to train them to be ready. To me, it's supposed to be obvious. We're developing professionals. Graduate school is for training professionals. We didn't have a culture of graduate schools like MIT or Berkeley or Stanford. They have their own culture. We had to have our own equivalent culture in a positive way so that we can compete against MIT or Berkeley. That's the process. They should prepare to be a professional. And because it's a long-term game, they have to be healthy. If you have to work 10 to 15 hours a day for 4 or 5 years, then your physical condition has to be good. So I really love that idea that he kind of made these, you know, geeky programmer guys, you know, go rock climbing all day, and then would, you know, his wife would cook them dinner at the end of the day. And actually, one of his other students actually ended up meeting his future wife through one of these dinners, which I found kind of interesting. Anyway, any questions so far? No? All right. I wanted to move on to Senegal, which is a country that I lived in as an undergraduate in 2002-2003. I studied at in a city, second largest city in Senegal, in the northwest of the country, called Saint-Louis. And I ended up actually writing my undergraduate thesis while I was a student at Berkeley about the internet in Senegal and kind of how it came to be. And that was part of what kind of drew me back there, was to look at how the internet had developed. And when I went back to Senegal to do this book specifically in 2007, not a whole lot had changed in terms of how the internet was being used on kind of a day-to-day basis. For anybody who's traveled in the developing world, you probably know that there are lots of kind of informal cyber cafes in many parts of the world, and oftentimes they're quite cheap. They cost, you know, maybe a dollar, maybe less per hour to use. And one day I was in Senegal, and I was staying with a family there for a couple of weeks while I was doing research, and I had a really interesting experience at a cyber cafe that it kind of opens the Senegal part of my book, where there was this kind of young Senegalese kid, and he was trying to research about kind of college admissions and stuff, and so I just thought I'd read you this part. The Cyber Cafe on Rue Yoff, 403, Dakar, Senegal, January 20th, 2007. At certain places in Dakar, paved roads disappear into the natural sand like a foot being buried into a slipper. One such street in Yoff, a traditional fishing village that is transforming itself into a middle-class neighborhood, is such a place. Here, upscale gated buildings and fancy clothiers mingle with a small roadside barber's hut. The salon is separated from the street by a thin curtain sliding on a simple string. As is the case in nearly every neighborhood of this incomprehensible city, the gritty but well-stocked boutiques flank the street as dependable commercial bulwarks. Coming from the main road, the pragmatically named Route de l'Aéroport, Airport Road, it's very easy to miss the tattered wooden sign in the shape of an arrow nailed 6 feet up an electrical pole adjacent to one such boutique. This arrow proudly displays, in green paint, Cyber à 60 mètres, which means that there's a cyber cafe about 60 meters down the intersecting street, Rue Yoff 403. The street's name is marked on a French-style blue metal sign. This street sign is so new that hardly any of the locals know the name of their own street, that is, assuming they can read it at all. After all, only 4 out of every 10 Senegalese are literate in French, the former colonial and still official language. Far fewer can read or write in their native language, Wolof, Pular, Mandinka, or Jola. Further down Rue Yoff 403 stands a liquor store, where bottles of beer are displayed on sterile white shelves as if they were objets d'art, each standing tall, keeping their distance from their brethren. The store remains empty, and like many things in Senegal, it's not clear entirely why. It could be because it's a quiet and lazy Saturday morning, or because the majority of people in Senegal are Muslim and thus don't drink, or at least their neighbors don't think that they do. A few doors down past the liquor store sits the cyber cafe. Touba Cyber is named for the Senegalese Muslim holy city of Touba, the seat of the Mourids, the indigenous religious brotherhood that exerts a large influence over all economic and political affairs in the country. Touba Cyber might otherwise be easily missed, as there's not much that marks its presence, save one thin wooden white door with a glass window. Typical of most Senegalese cyber cafes, Touba Cyber retains a quiet appearance. They tend to be lit mainly by a little daylight mixed with the pale glow of computer monitors. Most continue throughout the day in near silence, with the clientele absorbed into their MSN Messenger chat sessions, their emails, or European football news. Silent, that is, until someone forgets to turn down the speakers or put on headphones while blaring a new American rap video from YouTube. A bank of 6 computers, including one laptop, stands at the ready, each with its own wooden divider. On this Saturday morning, the only Senegalese customer is Ibrahima Yok, an 18-year-old who lives about a 5-minute walk away from Touba Cyber. Yok has just finished high school and is taking a year off to better his English by taking some courses at the Université Cheikh Anta Diop in Dakar, the only university in the city, in the capital city, while he puts together his application for European, Canadian, and American universities. While this sounds like an admirable and practical plan, his approach to learning about American universities isn't quite laid out with the same rigor. He's typing étudier aux USA, studying in the USA, into Google and clicking through the various results. He's just stumbled upon the State University of New York at Rockland, where he's begun filling out an online form to request admissions information. Yok explains that he comes to the cyber cafe at least 2 to 3 times during the week and often 4 or 5 times in the weekend, particularly when he doesn't have much to do. Back when he started using the internet in 2001, when getting online required a 15-minute bus ride, he'd often have to wait for 20 or 30 minutes just to get online. He'd spend his 500 CFA, about a dollar, for a single hour at the cyber cafe, where he'd look up music videos of the American rapper Sisqó and check the site of his favorite soccer team, Juventus of Turin, Italy. Like many Senegalese kids, Yok sought out cyber cafes as a cheap form of interactive entertainment. Of all of the schools that Yok would find on this day, why was he looking up information from SUNY Rockland, a small community college in the Hudson River Valley? It's in New York, he says, in a slight huff, almost scoffing at the notion. Yok initially doesn't realize that just because a school has New York in its name, that it doesn't mean that it's actually in the city of New York. He seems slightly disappointed after being shown on a map that the school is actually in Suffern, about 55 kilometers or 35 miles away from Manhattan. After an hour of clicking through Google search results in the quiet cyber cafe, Yok pays the kid running the manager's table the 250 CFA francs, 50 cents, that he's owed. The door bangs quietly as he steps out onto the sandy street, Rue Yoff 403. So that's just kind of a little scene, and I wanted to have that be the opening part of the Senegal chapter to kind of talk about how the internet in Senegal kind of goes through these kind of fits and spurts. There were various Government project. I mentioned that there was this government project, or there have been various government projects, both from the U.S. and from Senegal, that have really tried to push internet access in places like Senegal. One of the more recent ones that was actually pushed from within the government of Senegal itself was something called the Digital Solidarity Fund, and this was pushed by the president of Senegal himself, Abdoulaye Wade. And part of the idea of that project was that people, so like people like us, who would have the money available to us, you know, when you go to buy an iPhone or a laptop or something in a store, the idea is that the clerk would say to you, you know, would you like to donate $5 or $10 or $20 to donate to this Digital Solidarity Fund as a way to kind of make computers and internet access cheaper for people in the developing world? This didn't really go anywhere. But and that was just kind of a string of a number of similar types of projects that have tried to get internet access to work in places like the developing world, and it hasn't for a number of reasons, due to, you know, failed deregulation of Senegalese telecom, and also just the more basic fact, and this is something that I also talk about in the book, that education levels in Senegal remain quite low. Again, only 40% of the people are literate, and I think that's something that often gets forgotten. Okay, I wanted to move on to Estonia and talk a little bit about Skype and the creation of Skype. Estonia is a country. I was having a conversation with somebody earlier about how, you know, Estonia, as I'm sure you all know, was formerly part of the Soviet Union. And Estonia was a country that I actually didn't know anything about until I started working on this book. And I kind of have become a little bit obsessed with Estonia. I've traveled there 5 times in the last 6 years, and I first kind of latched onto Estonia because of its technology. I read an article in the Christian Science Monitor saying that Estonia had declared internet access to be a human right, and that just kind of blew me away. And then I read about how they had free Wi-Fi all over the place, and then Skype had come from there, and Estonia was the first country in the world to have internet voting in a national election. They have this crazy system of digital ID cards that everybody has. Something like almost 90% of people pay their taxes online now in Estonia. It's pretty amazing. I profile a guy in Estonia whose name is Veljo Hammer, who basically has gone around all of Estonia telling people, preaching the gospel of free Wi-Fi, basically. And so if you ever go there, you'll see that there's free Wi-Fi in the airport, in hotels, in cafes, in libraries, in supermarkets, in hospitals, in trains and buses and all kinds of weird places. And I think because he was kind of the prime mover in a small country like Estonia, where it only has 1.3 million people, I mean, New York City is many more times bigger than the whole country of Estonia, population-wise. I think he's had a kind of a real effect on kind of setting these standards of, what they've been able to do. So another thing that I think a lot of people don't know about Estonia, that I didn't know about Estonia before I started working on this, is that when it was under the Soviet influence, the Soviet government really controlled what people, well, they controlled a lot of things, but one of the things that they controlled in terms of academia and education was what Estonians could study. And so they didn't want Estonians to study liberal arts and political science and things like that. What they did want them to study, actually, as it turns out, was science and engineering. The Soviets actually built something called the Institute of Cybernetics in Tallinn in the 1970s. And so they had quite a advanced level of engineering and of this type of computer science and information science that they were able to use to their advantage when Estonia became independent in 1991. And actually, I find it kind of interesting that Skype's first home, their very first office, was actually in the Institute of Cybernetics when they first came about in 2003. And so I just wanted to read kind of the little bit of the creation story of Skype. Institute of Cybernetics, Tallinn, Estonia, April 2003. Hey guys, it looks like it works now, said Tavit Hinrikus, giddily holding a laptop to his ear like an oversized cell phone. He was standing at one end of the cavernous hallway, deep in the bowels of the Institute of Cybernetics, where Skype had set up shop earlier that year. A few of the other employees were standing nearby, at various links down the hallway, looking equally ridiculous with computers open to their ears and mouths. The rest of the employees watched, their glances darting from one end of the hallway to the other. The simple idea behind Skype was to make calling over the internet as simple as picking up a phone, and those calls, to anywhere in the world, should be free. Henricus was one of Skype's original 10 employees, and was one of its first managers at the age of 22. Toivo Anus, another manager, held up his laptop at the other end of the hallway. "Yes," he spoke, with the usual reserved modesty of most Estonians, "I can hear you." This experiment proved that Skype worked. One could now easily make calls from any computer to any other computer via the internet, regardless of distance between the two machines. A few months later, on Friday, August 29, 2003, the team released the first version for Windows of Skype. On the following Monday, there were 10,000 downloads, even though the company had done no marketing or any kind of public announcement. By the end of the week, 60,000 users had downloaded the software. Skype wasn't the first company to conceive of using the internet to make phone calls, but it quickly became the simplest, easiest, and best. Prior to Skype, internet phone calls were unreliable at best, and essentially only for those who were savvy and patient enough to want to try it. Getting such calls to work before the days of Skype required proper configurations of firewalls, network latency, and audio settings. Or, as Henricus, Skype's former director of strategy, recalled later, if you were a geek and you took the effort to configure it, you could make those pre-Skype applications work. He added, underscoring Skype's intention of simplicity, quote, "Skype was designed for your mom to call you, or for you to call your mom from college." Henricus and his then-girlfriend became two of the original beta testers, as she was studying in the Netherlands at the time. As they talked for hours for free each night, he became very motivated very quickly to make sure that the software worked properly. Two Scandinavian entrepreneurs, Nicolas Zennström and Janus Friis, conceived of this new company as a telecommunications force to be reckoned with. In fact, the story of the company name reveals a little bit about the early history of the company itself. One of the early names that Zennström, Friis, and the other founders considered was Sky Peer-to-Peer, which seemed far too long and cumbersome. That then got abbreviated to Skyper. However, there already were Skyper domain names, so wanting something unique, they shortened it further to Skype. The company's founders had been the previous masterminds of Kazaa, a controversial peer-to-peer application, a more advanced version of the original Napster, that allowed users to easily pirate music, movies, and software. And just as Kazaa paved the way for upending the music and film industry, spurring the major studios to get behind legal digital downloads, so too did they want Skype to revolutionize the telecommunications industry. Zennström and Friis had the idea of combining the underlying technology of Kazaa, which allowed for a decentralized network, with each computer sharing some of the load with making calls over the internet. As Friis told CNetNews.com in 2003, "After Zennström and I did Kazaa, we looked at the other areas where we could use our experience and where P2P technology could have a major disruptive impact. The telephony market is characterized both by what we think is a rip-off pricing and a reliance on heavily centralized infrastructure. We just couldn't resist the opportunity to help shake this up a bit." The duo quickly hired an Estonian, Toivo Anus, who managed three core programmers from Kazaa, Jan Tallinn, Priit Kaiselu, and Ahti Heinla. This trio, possibly the best programming team in all of Estonia, had known each other since 1992, when they founded Estonia's first video game company, Blue Moon Software. The core developer team was set up in Tallinn, mainly because there were a lot of high-quality programmers available for relatively cheap. Like many other projects in Estonia, Skype moved fast, going from concept to launch in 8 months. In late 2005, eBay acquired Skype for $2.6 billion, then sold the company to a group of private investors for $2.75 billion 4 years later. The team of original programmers, including Henricus, went on to found a venture capital firm called Ambient Sound Investments as a way to find and profit from the next generation of Estonian innovation. But perhaps Skype finally went mainstream when Prime Minister Andrus Ansip gave President George W. Bush a Skype phone during the American leader's visit to Estonia in November 2006. I also go on to talk about in Estonia the cyber attack that you may have heard about that happened in 2007. This happened as a result. There was a bunch of stories in Wired and lots of other places about how after the Estonian government had decided to move a Soviet war memorial statue outside of town, there was about 2 days of riots. One person was killed, and then there were basically 2 weeks of cyber attacks against Estonian government and media websites and banking websites as well. And as a result, NATO decided to create the Center of Excellence in Cyber Defense in Estonia the following year, in 2008. So I wanted to move on to my final country, Iran, and talk a little bit about how, Iran is a really interesting country. It's a country that I have a personal interest in. My father is Iranian, and I have extended family in Iran. I've only been to Iran once, within the last few years, especially with the election a couple of years ago, I've become more and more interested in kind of how the internet is used in Iran. And there's been some research and previous work that's been done about how the internet is used in Iran, but I had a chance to interview a lot of young journalists and bloggers and people who use the internet to kind of further their own political speech. And I profile one young journalist and blogger who was arrested in 2004. And he became part of a group of young Iranian journalists, all of whom I'm pretty sure now live outside of Iran, who were arrested. And I think that that's something that often gets lost in, a lot of people talk about, can the internet be a liberating force, a democratizing force, all this kind of stuff. And in recent months, we've seen the effects of the internet or the effects of social media in places like Egypt and Tunisia. But I think something that often gets lost in that discussion is the use of actual force and the use of kind of prosecuting people and arresting people and using physical violence against people as a way to intimidate them. And I think that that's something that people often forget. In Egypt, to me, the big difference between a place like Egypt and a place like Libya is that Libya is shooting their own people and the Egyptian army didn't. And I think, to me, the social changes have more to do with that than they have to do with how the internet was used. So I wanted to, the opening of the Iran section of my book talks about how this young journalist, Omid Memarian, got arrested and how he came to be arrested. So I just thought I'd read a little bit of that and then we can finish up. Tehran, October 10th, 2004. Omid Memarian finished a quick chat with a coworker and turned around to walk the few steps back toward his desk in the office of the Iranian non-governmental organization, Volunteer Actors. Looking up, about to enter his own office, he saw two men waiting for him. They had close-cropped beards and wore suits, Iranian style, without ties. They spoke sharply and directly, without so much as a salam. "Please come with us downstairs to respond to some questions," said the leader in a flat, stern voice. "Why should I come with you?" Memarian responded indignantly. "You know about all the shit that you have done," the man said, biting each word with a staccato tone. "Don't play games with us." "Do you have a judicial order, a warrant?" Memarian cried out, his voice strengthening with a tinge of fear. "Who are you? Why should I come with you?" Memarian was also a blogger and one who had used the new medium to publish a number of potentially incendiary posts that no Iranian newspaper would dare touch. Many of the posts covered city politics and local corruption. By Western norms, these writings would have been standard fare for any local media outlet. But in Iran, the red lines were constantly shifting, particularly with more and more liberal journalists and writers turning to the web as traditional media got shut down. Memarian is among the first generation of Iranian bloggers, an entire generation emblematic of 21st century Iran who are young, educated, and wired. Nearly 70% of the population is under the age of 30. The average person has completed high school. Many also go on to universities, where women outnumber men. And roughly 35 to 40% of the population is online. As a result, this internet-savvy, socially repressed, economically depressed, politically active generation grew up as the infrastructure and tools of the Iranian internet matured, and it was only a matter of time before the two joined. This union created an internet whose most important application was fighting back against the establishment, which in turn forced the Islamic Republic itself to use co-optive and coercive means to try to seize control of its online community. Ultimately, in extreme times, it has resorted to authoritarian regimes. It has resorted to authoritarian means, including interrogations and jailings, to keep online dissidents at bay. Memarian also knew that 18 months earlier, his good friend and fellow journalist Sina Motalebi had become the first blogger anywhere in the world to be arrested for what he wrote online. Memarian spoke out against Motalebi's arrest on his own blog. Although Memarian didn't know it at the time, in the weeks before the bearded man arrived at his office, many of his journalist and blogger colleagues had also been arrested under similar dubious circumstances in other parts of the city. In fact, a friend had called Memarian 2 days earlier to find out if he had to find out if he himself had been arrested. Memarian suspected that there was a possibility that he himself might be taken into custody too. In addition to being a journalist, Memarian ran Volunteer Actors, a nonprofit that provided training to other grassroots and civil society nonprofits in Iran. While Memarian stared down these mysterious men, his co-workers leaned in at a distance, trying not to attract their attention. The men's presence was enough to stop any movement in the office. Faces went silent as confusion and fear sank into the other five employees. The second man slid the lower half of his suit jacket along his waistband, revealing a cold metal pistol holstered at his side, and glared at Memarian. The first man stood by silently and waited for Memarian to comply. That was his answer. "Bring your bag," the first man said, gesturing to the shoulder bag resting up against the foot of Memarian's desk. He thought fast. There wasn't any incriminating information on that laptop, but it did have some emails, photos, and other documents, including a recent invitation to the United States and the Netherlands, that these men might be able to twist out of him. "It's the office's bag. It's not mine," Memarian said quickly. The ploy worked, and moments later, Memarian followed them quietly out of the office, trying not to show how frightened he was becoming. He felt as if he needed to diffuse the tension among his co-workers. After all, he'd helped to start the organization and didn't want any of them to get dragged into the situation. The first man led the way down the three flights of stairs, and the second man followed behind. He could feel the second man's eyes piercing the back of his neck. He had never been held at gunpoint before. As they marched him out of the office, the leader quickly produced a list of names, with Memarian's on it, and barked more orders. When the trio got to the ground floor, the two men paraded him through the lobby and onto the street. Two more bearded suits were waiting, flanking both sides of the main door, and as the three passed, they fell into position behind the group. As the quintet approached a parked and waiting black car and van, Memarian could see that there were two more suits to the left, a few hundred feet away, standing in the middle of the street, and another pair to the right, effectively barricading the other end of the block. Someone had sent a total of 10 men, at least one of whom was armed, to apprehend one thin, 30-year-old, clean-shaven journalist. Memarian was an active member of civil society, a thinker, a budding politician, a journalist, and perhaps most dangerously, a blogger. He didn't think that he could outrun any of them. After seeing this, Memarian turned to the first man, who seemed to be in charge, and said incredulously, "Do you really think I'm going to escape?" The leader ignored the question and spoke to the driver of the car. "We got him," he said. "You can go." Then the leader whipped out a walkie-talkie and spoke quickly to someone, presumably at the men's headquarters. "We arrested him. Omid Memarian." Only after this transmission did Memarian realize how serious things were getting. He had no chance to mentally prepare for whatever was about to befall him or to alert his family and friends. Put simply, whoever they were, wanted Memarian to disappear. So he did make it out of prison. He lives in San Francisco now. That pretty much, I think, sums up the parts that I wanted to read, and I'm happy to take questions or comments or hear what you guys have to say, if anything.
I'll start with the most basic question. In terms of developing countries or countries that started with a less of a technological infrastructure, which do you think were most successful in terms of, what strategies were most successful in terms of combination of public and private investment and regulation or deregulation? Which do you think jump-started most effectively?
There was actually a U.S. government project that was very instrumental that I'm not sure a lot of people outside of the core kind of ISOC group know about, and that was something called the Leland Initiative that happened back in the 90s. That was a U.S. Government project that was literally set up to establish the very first internet connections in many countries in Africa and other parts of the world. So I think that as kind of an initial stage, that was very effective. More recently, I think something that is effective, and I think now that it's been shown over the last decade that mobile penetration vastly outweighs internet penetration and computer penetration, I think that both governments, policymakers, and companies need to figure out how to kind of leverage that to their advantage. And actually, it was Vint Cerf who said to me, he said, you know, people who are growing up in Africa now are going to be using the internet very differently than how you and I use the internet, you know, on computers, right? People, more and more people in the developing world are going to be using it for the first time on something that they can hold in their hand. And especially as now we get things like iPads and, you know, other tablet, smaller computers that are cheaper, you know, that are coming around, that will kind of change the way that people use it. I mean, I think one of the most exciting things that I think that has come out of Africa is something that I alluded to or mentioned earlier, and that's called M-Pesa. I don't know how many people know about that. That's a mobile payment system that exists in Kenya and Uganda. And I think something like half of the, maybe even more than half, of mobile phone users in these countries use it. And basically, it's a way you can exchange phone credit for cash, basically. And you can use it as a way to transfer money. Remittances and so forth. So you can send money, I can send money to you, and you can redeem that as credit or as actual cash. You can pay cab fares with it.
So these are just basically your debit cards.
Yeah, but it's not even, right, but it's not like, yeah, so if, for people who've used mobile phones in many parts of the developing world, you know, you have these like prepaid top-up type deals. Yeah, it's sort of like that. Basically, the way it works is you go to a kiosk and you say, "Hi, I want to put $5 on my account, or I want to send you $5," and then you get sent a code and you take it to your local kiosk and it says, "Here, I'm owed $5," and then they give you the money. And that payment system, you know, has really taken off, and I think mainly because there's an incentive for people to use it, like, you know, transferring money. Especially for many people who don't have bank accounts, is hard, especially larger sums of money. It uses a technology that people already have, which is mobile phones. And it's easy for people who are illiterate to use, right? You don't need to, like, all you need to know is, you just need to know how to read numbers in order to use it. And I think that that's something that, you know, because... I don't know that it's it's a good question. I don't think it's anonymous. I've never actually used it myself, so I don't know for certain. But I mean, I presume it would tell you that, you know, person A sent you.
If you have a prepaid phone where there's no information.
Yeah, but it probably says that it came from such and such number, I would imagine.
Right.
I don't know if
that number has no identity.
Yeah, I mean, but some of these countries have like SIM card registration and stuff, so I don't know. I don't know exactly, but yeah. Anyway, yeah.
As entertaining as the anecdotes are, what I'm sort of, the reason I came tonight is I'm really interested in what has emerged out of this ultra band, broadband installation known as South Korea. What new things are they doing? You know, there's always the notion that if you build it, the applications will emerge from that. And I'm, did you find any of that? Is any of that in the book?
I mean, I think that one of the things that is there's a lot of things that are happening. I don't know that there's anything that is kind of really life changing in terms of like how people. I think it's just something that people kind of take for granted now because it's just there. And there, I know that they're also working on, and I do talk about this in the book. They're building something called. They're building a. How do you describe it? They're building something called a ubiquitous city, up near the border with North Korea, up near the Incheon, Seoul Incheon Airport, and this is a place called New Songdo City, and this is kind of like super planned, super high tech, RFID, Wi-Fi, WiMAX everywhere. kind of thing. And they want that to be kind of like a business hub. They want people to be able to check, you know, surveillance cameras of the internet to use, to have just kind of ubiquitous networking.
Right, but that's sort of a top-down plan. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at, you know, you've got people that have 100 megs or better in their home. They've had it for 10 years or so. What has emerged from the bottom up, even if it's just gaming?
Yeah, I mean,
video conferencing applications.
Yeah.
Are they addicted to Skype? Do they not use Skype?
I would say that the two kind of main things that I do talk about, one is gaming, which you mentioned, and I don't know if people know this, but Korea has, I would say, probably the most developed, like, professional computer gaming culture league. They call it the eSports League in the world. And it's kind of bizarre that, like, there are these literally dozens of, you know, 18, 19, 20-year-old boys that play, that are paid to play StarCraft, like tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of dollars per year.
For example, one of the things I find fascinating is they've had these cafes where they go to play,
yeah,
so that they can sort of be in the same space but not really talking to each other, but play on the LAN, yet they have the ability to have the high-speed, you know, gaming against each other on the WAN, on the wide area network, and yet they go to these places. I mean,
yeah, there's
the kind of thing. Sociological.
Yeah, there are these in Korean, I don't speak Korean, but there are these places called PC bongs that are these basically cyber cafes, like you said, and PC bongs really kind of exploded after the Asian financial crisis of 1998, because they were pretty a pretty cheap way to make money, and there was a lot of available kind of office space and retail space. And that was also around the time when broadband was getting more, you know, cheaper and cheaper. And that is kind of how that led to the professional gaming, was because, like you said, a lot of people, even though maybe they could do it at home, there were these kind of clans that formed, like groups of friends would get together and they would, like, rent out a PC bong for, like, a Saturday night, and they would play StarCraft forever. And, you know, a lot of them got really, really good at it. And I think that this is also something that kind of is interesting about Korean culture. As best as I understand it, you know, like, many kind of middle class and upper class Korean families put a lot of pressure on their children, you know, to they go to these what are called hagwons, which are these kind of like after school, like, tutoring kind of program things, where they can study English and math and all kinds of like extra subjects. And, you know, but a lot of kids kind of, as a way to kind of get away from their parents and get away from schools, they spend their time playing StarCraft. And so so there are those kinds of applications that come about as well. It's interesting, though, that some of that leads to, in some cases, negative effects. Actually, you may know that there have been a number of cases where Koreans have died from playing computer games for 40 hours, 50 hours at a stretch. And Korea actually has a program now for a government-run program combating against cyber addiction and gaming addiction. And I talk about that a little bit. But another thing that I think that emerged that's interesting about how the internet is used in Korea is the way that it kind of has been used to galvanize people politically. And I talk about the rise of a guy who eventually became the president of Korea, Roh Moo-hyun, and he ran kind of a failed campaign, and then some people kind of rallied behind him. And where these people got together and they started a fan club called Rosamo, which is a Korean acronym meaning people who love Ro. That was the guy's name, and the place that they founded it was in a PC bong, actually, and so they used a lot of Korean. There's some Korean social networking websites, and also Korean online news websites. There were one of the earliest and most well-known kind of citizen journalism, amateur journalism sites was a website called Oh My News, that was started by a Korean who'd studied in the U.S. And when Roe was elected president, the first interview that he granted was to actually this online news organization, Oh My News. And a lot of people view that as kind of him kind of suggesting that they were kind of the, because they covered his campaign a lot and were kind of suggesting that, that they kind of pushed him over the edge.
But are you assuming that that speed does not matter?
No,
not at all. That high speed doesn't generate different applications that we won't see other places?
I don't know that it... That's a good question. I mean, I think that without high speed, you can't have... Without a lot of kind of ubiquitous high speed, I don't think you can have gaming in the same way that Korea does. I mean, Korea has high speed... I mean, it allows for various kind of commercial applications that I haven't seen to the same degree in the U.S. I mentioned... Well, like, okay, so... I think I mentioned that I now live in Germany. I used to live in California. Up till a couple of years ago, you couldn't even send a text message on the BART in the Bay Area. Like if you were taking the BART from Oakland to San Francisco under the San Francisco Bay, like there was no mobile service, not even internet. Just like you couldn't even send a text. Right. The first time I went to Korea in 2007, on the Seoul Metro underground. The very first thing that I saw was a guy on his way home from work in a suit on his cell phone, you know, on this fast-moving subway train watching a live baseball game broadcast over his mobile phone network. And that, you know, and this was 2007, and I just thought that was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen. And I thought that it was kind of ironic that, you know, in the Bay Area where I was living at the time, this kind of hotbed of technology didn't have anything close to that. You know.
Thank you, Pac Bell.
Yeah.
Kind of take what was said before a little farther. You've surveyed these four countries, and then we also know something about our own. What if anything would you say is the commonality? What is there anything that is common between any country that happens when the internet is established? Anything that you can say for sure, regardless of these different societies, anything that you can say this happens, I guess I'm trying to say is there any sort of implied and necessary change, societal change that happens when the internet is introduced en masse?
That's a good question. That's a really good question. I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, on the one hand, I feel like I want to say, you know, that there is this, kind of idea that I feel like one thing that does happen is that people in various communities, the kind of, it definitely allows social groups to form more easily that maybe otherwise wouldn't have formed as fast. You know, it allows hackers to find each other. It allows people who like cats to find each other, you know, like things like that. But I guess for me, what's interesting is that, yeah, these various things happen, in these different kinds of ways. And something that I've learned that, you know, I didn't write about this in the book, but, you know, since I've been living in Germany and have been a technology journalist in Germany, is something that comes up time and time, literally almost every week, are issues of data protection and privacy, right? There was Google Street View, which just came out in Germany at the end of last year, there was like this big brouhaha in Germany about because the German politicians and German people were really upset because they felt that it was a big invasion of their privacy to have Google driving around Germany taking pictures of people's houses. And I found that really interesting that, on the one hand, Germans find Street View offensive, but on the other hand, when you live anywhere in Germany, as soon as you arrive in a particular city or any city, you have to go to the city hall and fill out a form, and it basically says, "Hi, I'm here. Here's where I live," right? And when you move apartments or houses, you have to do that again, even if it's within the same city. And Germans don't bat an eye at that; they think that that's totally normal. And I find that it's interesting. In the U.S., it's totally the opposite, right? If every American had to register, or every person living in the U.S. had to register at the city hall every time they moved, I think people would freak out. But Street View, yeah, no problem. You know, it's fine. So I don't really have a good answer to that question.
Well, I can try a different question. I mean, going back to the speed thing before, I was just watching some talks on the U.S. National Broadband Initiative and about that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been sort of some qualms saying, like, you know, what's the most important aspect here? is it speed, some people seem to think, or is it like ubiquity? Because, so, I guess I'm saying, what do you think? What do you think, when we're talking about internet adoption by a large percentage of society,
mm-hmm.
what aspect or aspects do you think might be the
Yeah, I think speed is an aspect. I think it's important, though, not to get too hung up on speed, because, I mean, I think the kind of minimum level of tolerance changes over time as new applications get developed on top of that. You know, I think for many of us, you know, 5-10 years ago, we would have been thrilled with a megabit, and now that seems like deadly slow, I think, to a lot of us. So I think that that kind of changes. You know, I think that, if you live in a place, if you live in rural, you know, Iran or China or Russia or Senegal, you know, you probably don't have necessarily many options, you know. I mean, and even here in the U.S., you know, sometimes there's monopoly-type situations where you only have the choice between a couple of providers. So I think that there's a lot of – I mean, I'm generally in favor of more and cheaper and faster access for everybody. You know, and I think that – I mean, one project that Finland actually passed a law – I believe it was like 2 years ago, that basically said that all Finns, no matter where they live, have to have the commercial possibility to buy 1 megabit of access anywhere in Finland. And by 2015, that would get up to 100 megabits. And that the Finnish government would subsidize, they wouldn't subsidize you, your personal connection, but if, like, you know, whatever Finnish telecom company was like, oh, no, we can't put internet in, like, the North Pole because it costs too much. The Finnish government would subsidize that. And so they wanted to make sure that it was possible for everybody to buy access if they wanted it. And I, you know, and I think that's a pretty bold plan. Yeah. There's a question back here.
Yeah. So I'm really interested in kind of the first question, which was, I guess, public versus private as a way of generating penetration,
mm-hmm.
but also kind of merging with the previous comment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just blanking for a second on one of the things that you responded was a perfect transition. I forget what it was. But I mean, I'm really interested in types of models of ownership, like public versus private.
Mm-hmm.
And so, oh, right, it was the Germany thing about mm-hmm. You know, different people's perceptions of privacy, public government, municipal,
mm-hmm.
public versus private.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, what models of ownership have you encountered in these different places? Have you seen, like, different mixes of, like, publicness?
Well, yeah, like Korea, for example. Korea is a really fascinating country for a lot of reasons, but it's actually very... it was designed very much from the government level, like a lot of the, I mean, like this whole graduate research program and stuff, that was definitely kind of top-down kind of thing. And then there were a number of, you know, they decided to establish kind of a government telecom monopoly, and then there were other companies that were, they decided to demonopolize that, and then other kinds of things. Basically, what I'm trying to say is that there were, you know, I think that if you allow companies to compete... once kind of the stuff is that, I mean, if you don't have the wiring to begin with, and I don't know that there's that many places in the world that are in that situation anymore, but I think, well, I guess so. But, you know, I think that once you get into a position where you can have I mean, part of the reason also why broadband in Korea is so ubiquitous is because there were, like, major, major price wars between, like, 3 or 4 companies in, like, the late 90s and early 2000s. You know, and they just kept driving the price further and further down as they tried to undercut each other. And I think when you have real competition like that, that you can get in that type of situation. I mean, one of the reasons why in Senegal, why the internet penetration is low, and there's a lot of reasons, but is because even though on paper they no longer have a telecom monopoly, you know, the telecom monopoly ended like 7 years ago on paper. In reality, it ended like 4 years ago, and so there's now 2 internet providers for the whole country. This is a country of like 11 million people. And so there's and there's also weird issues now, especially in Africa, of places like so Senegal gets all of its access from undersea data cables that run along its western coast, and you know, and other countries in the area, like Mali, neighboring countries that aren't coastal countries like Mali, they have to buy access from Senegal, which inflates the price for them. So I think that basically, you know, I think more kinds of projects to bring higher levels of access so there aren't kind of choke points, I think is a key element. And also I think that's another important thing, you know, if we talk about freedom of speech and freedom of expression, I mean, as we saw in Egypt and Iran to some degree as well, when you have an authoritarian government that has, you know, literally single-digit numbers of connections, internet connections to the outside world that can be cut, you know, like that, that's kind of a frightening prospect.
Following up on that, even not talking about getting to the internet outside, but just communicating amongst each other,
mm-hmm.
You know, when in Iran was the first example of when they actually sort of shut everything down, they shut the cell phones down.
Mm-hmm.
What initiatives are they showing to like work around that in terms of like ad hoc mesh networking or other solutions?
Well, the one of the cool solutions that I didn't see any of this happen in after the aftermath of the Iranian 2009 situation, but more recently with Libya and Egypt and stuff, was there's this group that some of you guys may have heard of called Telecomics. They started in Germany and Sweden. This is tele, like television, and comics with an X. Germany, Sweden, France, they're all over the place. I saw somebody online refer to them as the nicer, gentler Anonymous, which I thought was kind of funny. One of the things that they did that I thought was really cool was they rang up a bunch of ISPs across Europe, some in Canada and Australia and other places too, and said, hey, do you guys still have your modem banks? And they were like, yeah. And so they're like, hey, can you give us the numbers so that people in Egypt and stuff can call with modems? Like, dial up. That's exactly what they did. And the way that they told people what numbers they should call was they basically spam faxed fax machines across Egypt and Libya and Tunisia and stuff. They basically looked up like offices of like computer stores and tech groups and people that they thought might be vaguely sympathetic and just sent faxes to like random numbers, and they had people dialing ISPs in France, you know?
I know in Libya they talked about how, because in Benghazi there was a database that linked SIM cards to telephone numbers.
Yeah.
You know, allowed them to set up an independent network.
There was a cool piece in the Wall Street Journal that talked about that, about how, in the rebel part of Libya, how they've been able to kind of create their own mobile phone network. And I was a little bit surprised that we didn't see any of that in the Iranian situation. And it may have had to do with geopolitics or just what was going on at the time. But I was surprised, you know, because like I read about in, I believe it was Tunisia, where people were... Or excuse me, Libya, where people were literally shuttling between, or there was a couple of people that were shuttling between Tunisia and Libya as a way to get information out, like literally putting stuff on flash drives and driving it to somewhere where there was internet and then uploading it. And I was a little bit surprised that people in Iran weren't doing the same thing with like Turkey, because Turkey is one of the few countries that Iranians can go to without visas or anything like that. And you know, just going to the border areas or going into Turkey and just accessing stuff from there. You could, yeah. You totally could. Or even like if you if you were to get Turkcell, one of the big Turkish mobile providers, to really boost their coverage along the border, you know, maybe the Iranian government wouldn't be too happy about that, but...
There was an op-ed in the New York Times just when the Libya thing started going down, which suggested that the Americans should take a boat and go be offshore and run a sort of, like, you know, a wireless ISP and run the communications from offshore. And I liked it on Facebook. And some other guy wrote me a very nasty thing saying, I thought you knew something about communications. You're so naive to think that this could ever work.
Air Force has planes with a full data center inside of it. So if they, they would have to invade the airspace there. This is for the digital battlefield. They fly the plane over where there's a battle, and they can have tanks and troops coordinated and something like that. Very sophisticated, encrypted, but capable of doing IP. And so that technology is there, U.S. military technology, in planes to do that. They don't have to be offshore. They invaded the airspace and stayed in the air, obviously. Consistent pattern, they could do it.
Yeah.
But what about mesh? There's been some mesh initiatives in Germany, I understand. Do you know about that?
I'm not super familiar. I know mesh networking generally about it. I don't know of specific initiatives, no.
In Korea, when you said they were competitors, were they actually putting in separate wires, or were they based on one wire and they had different people using the same wire?
I believe it was more the latter. I think that a lot of it, the Korean power company initially, when they laid many of their electric cables, they laid a lot of fiber at the time, and in fact, that was actually initially one of the broadband companies was basically the Korean government realizing that they had a lot of this fiber that was not being used, and they realized that they could run internet access over it, and it was already there, and they already had the rights and all that kind of stuff. So
this is all public versus private, or public versus private versus ad hoc wireless. What if, in terms of connectivity, what about in terms of content or applications or services or content ownership?
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen different models of ownership, or in terms of public versus private?
Ownership of what?
Say servers or applications or web services or places where people, all these things, a lot of these examples, for example, are still uploading content to YouTube or Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about connectivity.
Mm-hmm.
In some of these other instances, are there different possible models of publicness versus private in terms of where people are actually?
Where the data is stored, you mean?
Yeah. It's just kind of all people generating content for private on enterprise, basically, or other companies.
Or maybe tell me if I can elaborate.
Please. Yeah.
Are you thinking currently, for residential broadband servers, they're strongly discouraged from hosting your own server. It's really,
mm-hmm.
The upstream speed is a lot lower. They don't give you dedicated IPs. And they, the usage policy may specifically say no web servers in your house.
Right.
That type of thing. So I think that that's part of what your question is. In Korea, can I,
run a web server?
Can I just get residential broadband? Can I build a data center?
That's a good question. That's a good question. I'll have to. I'm not sure. That's a very good question. I don't know if you're. Is what you're saying is because the bandwidth is much higher, are you allowed to do that? Is that kind of what you're getting at?
That would be an example of one model, or maybe Diaspora, the NYU mm-hmm. Social network, which would be maybe somehow competing with a privatized, corporate Facebook type thing that. If people have more ubiquitous connectivity, could say set up personal servers as one option, or possibly even there are examples of municipal, civic, governmental, Library of Congress type things that might be digitizing content or allowing people to digitize content out, contribute.
I'm not aware of any kind of big kind of public commons things like that type of projects. They might be out there. Trying to think. One thing that they do in Estonia and Germany is also now trying to do it as well. This isn't quite exactly what you're talking about, but the government basically has kind of official government email for people, as a secure, government sanctioned, totally encrypted, end to end encryption stuff.
Do you think it's really secure from the government?
Depends how much you trust the government. In the Estonian case, I think they're using pretty well understood, open source public private key, you know, GPG style encryption if it's not GPG itself. You know, and people seem to be okay with that. I don't know that how many people are like in Germany what they want to do, and so like Deutsche Telekom, one of the big, you know, like T-Mobile, like the big company, they have this. Right, yeah, but in Germany they also have T-Mobile, so that's the same thing. But anyway, but so yeah, so they have a thing, and what they're kind of pitching it to people as is like, you know, if it's basically making encrypted email like secure and legally viable and liable. So like, if I email you and we have a contract and we don't send it over like, you know, super encrypted email, like, there's no way for you to be 100% sure that I sent you that email, and so that's like kind of what they're doing, and that's not, I don't think that's quite what you're driving at.
That's authentication.
Yeah, but I don't know that I have a good answer. I'm sorry. Yes.
Remember Sonia Murray, who we saw at that Wireless City event of One Economy, and she talked about the difference between One Economy works on serving the underserved, you know, in America and in Africa and places. And she said, you know, in America, it's like everybody's trying to get to the lowest common denominator. And in Africa, there's a different approach, which is they realize they can't give everybody internet. So what they do is they take small places, community, you know, what they call anchor institutions, and give them, you know, and businesses, and give them high speed, you know, like sort of, so 50 megabits so there's a different approach there. They're kind of, in some ways, they're leapfrogging.
There's a cool outfit out of San Francisco that maybe some of you might have heard of called Invinio. I've done a few stories about them. They do these types of projects where they bring, they originally started doing like basically, yeah, they would receive on a point-to-point long range, like 50-mile wireless from wherever the nearest internet spot was, wherever the nearest, you know, DSL or whatever line was, satellite line or something. And they would shoot it, hop it, you know, however many times to get to wherever it needed to go. And then they would set up, one of the first things they would do is they would set up using like an open SIP, like an open source Skype kind of deal, a PBX within, you know, a 2-kilometer radius or something. And so a group of 200 people would have basically their own free phone calling, and they designed it in such a way such that you didn't need to have, like, you could, they would hook up phones to the desktops, and you could just pick up a phone and call it like a phone. You didn't have to, like, again, even if you didn't know how to like type or use a computer or read or anything like that, you could just dial three numbers and call your buddy, like, you know, down in the next village or something. And I thought that was a pretty cool type of project.
Do you see in somewhere like Senegal, do you see anything in the equivalent of a startup culture that we have here with people, kids thinking up apps and...
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, I think that will come, and I hope that comes. I mean, I know that that Google actually just hired they hired like a regional manager for Senegal, in Senegal for Africa.
Could you do something like Foursquare in Senegal?
Well, I personally, I don't really see the point of Foursquare to begin with.
Location based.
I mean, yeah, I think you could do it. I mean, they've talked about like there is a French Senegalese kind of joint project that does exist where people can text a service and find out like what the market price of fish is and things like that. I don't know how widespread stuff like that is,
say Estonia,
mm-hmm.
How much is people using, you know, iPhones and these kind of applications as much as they do in America or not? Or
I mean, the last time I was in Estonia, I saw people with iPhones. They definitely do exist. I mean, again, you know, even I mean, I think it's easy to get.
I'm talking about geolocation. You know, geolocated, location-based sort of applications and, you know, things like Hunch and this kind of thing.
I haven't seen any particular uses of that any more so than anywhere else. I don't know of any unique websites to Estonia that are location-based services.
So here in New York, say, we're ahead of everybody else.
Perhaps. I mean, New York is where dodgeball emerged. And
we did have, as friends with Dennis, but also as NY, get in a plug for NYC Wireless, we did have the guy who did the wireless in Estonia come here when we used to have public meetings and do a whole presentation about it. So it was, there was a lot of cross-pollination between us. And
no, yeah, New York was a huge inspiration for wireless in Estonia. Jacob Farkas of NYC Wireless.
You know Jake?
I interviewed him for the book. told me about how a lot of the free Wi-Fi came about because of the free Wi-Fi in Bryant Park. And Veljo Hammer, the guy who started all of these Wi-Fi things in Estonia, he came and used the Wi-Fi in, I think it was like 2002. And just thought that it was like the coolest thing he'd ever seen. That definitely was a big inspiration for what he did in Estonia. So yeah. Anyway, thank you guys for coming. I have books to sell if you want. I have stickers, I have cards. You can email me, find me on Twitter and wherever else if you want. And thanks a lot.
Thanks very much for coming.
Thank you.